deftly shifting the conversation back to pleasant things. A coronation means a month of balls. We will need new dresses. She seems to include Taryn and me in this sweeping statement. Magnificent ones. Maddock nods, smiling his toothy smile.
Yes, yes, as many as you like. I would have you look your finest and dance your hardest.
I try to breathe slowly, to concentrate on just one thing. The pomegranate seeds on my plate, shining like rubies, wet with venison blood. After the coronation, Maddock said. I try to focus on that.
It only feels like never.
I'd love to have a court dress like the ones I've seen in Oriana's wardrobe. Opulent patterns intricately stitched on skirts of gold and silver, each as beautiful as the dawn. I focus on that, too. But then I go too far and imagine myself in that dress, sword at my hip, transformed. A true member of the court, a knight in the circle of falcons, and Cardan watching me from across the room, standing beside the king, laughing at my pretension, laughing like he knows this is a fantasy that won't ever be real. I pinch my leg until pain washes everything away.
You'll have to wear out the soles of your shoes, just like the rest of us,
Vivi says to me and Taryn. I bet Oriana's sick with worry that since Maddock encouraged you to dance, she can't stop you.
Horror of horrors. You might have a good time.
Oriana presses her lips together. That's not fair. Nor is it true. Vivi rolls her eyes.
If it wasn't true, I couldn't say it.
Enough, all of you.
Maddock slams his hand down on the table, making us all jump.
Coronations are a time when many things are possible. Change is coming, and there is no wisdom in crossing me.
I can't tell if he's talking about Prince Dane, or ungrateful daughters, or both. Are you afraid someone is going to try for the throne? Taryn asks. Like me, she has been raised on strategy, moves and countermoves, ambushes and upper hands. But unlike me, she has Oriana's talent for asking the question that will steer a conversation toward less rocky shores.
The Greenbrier lie, not to worry. Not me,
Maddock says. But he looks pleased to be asked.
Doubtless some of their subjects wish there was no blood crown and no high king at all. His heirs ought to be particularly careful that the armies of Faerie are satisfied. A well-seasoned strategist waits for the right opportunity.
Only someone with nothing to lose would attack the throne with you there to protect it, Oriana says primly.
There's always something left to lose, Vivi says,
and then makes a hideous face at Oak. He giggles. Oriana reaches for him and then stops herself. Nothing bad is actually happening, and yet I see the gleam in Vivi's cat eyes, and I'm not sure Oriana's wrong to be nervous. Vivi would like to punish Maddock, but her only power is to be a thorn in his side, which means occasionally tormenting Oriana through Oak. I know Vivi loves Oak. He's our brother, after all. But that doesn't mean she's above teaching him bad things. Maddock smiles at all of us, now the picture of contentment. I used to think he didn't notice all the currents of tension that ran through the family. But as I get older, I see that barely suppressed conflict doesn't bother him in the least. He likes it just as well as open war.
Perhaps none of our enemies are particularly good strategists.
Let's hope not, Oriana says distractedly, her eyes on Oak, lifting her glass of canary wine.
Indeed,
says Maddock.
Let's have a toast to the incompetence of our enemies.
I pick up my glass and knock it into Taryn's. Then drain it to the very dregs. There's always something left to lose. I think about that all through the dawn, turning it over in my head. Finally, when I can toss and turn no more, I pull on a robe over my nightgown and go outside into the late morning sun. Bright as hammered gold, it hurts my eyes when I sit down on a patch of clover near the stables, looking back at the house. All of this was my mother's before it was Oriana's. Mom must have been young and in love with Maddock back then. I wonder what it was like for her. I wonder if she thought she was going to be happy here. I wonder when she realized she wasn't. I have heard the rumors. It is no small thing to confound the High King's general, to sneak out of Faerie with his baby in your belly and hide for almost 10 years. She left behind the burned remains of another woman in the blackened husk of his estate. No one can say she didn't prove her toughness. If she'd just been a little luckier, Maddock would have never realized she was still alive. She had a lot to lose, I guess. I've got a lot to lose, too. But so what? Skip our lessons today, I tell Taryn that afternoon. I am dressed and ready early. Though I have not slept, I do not feel at all tired. Stay home. She gives me a look of deep concern as a pixie boy, newly indebted to Maddock, braids her chestnut hair into a crown. She is sitting primly at her dressing table, clad all in brown and gold. Telling me not to go means I should. Whatever you're thinking, stop. I know you're disappointed about the tournament. It doesn't matter, I say. Although, of course, it does. It matters so much that now, without hope of knighthood, I feel like a hole has opened up under me and I am falling through it. Maddock might change his mind. She follows me down the stairs, grabbing up our baskets before I can. And at least now you won't have to defy Cardan. I turn on her, even though none of this is her fault. Do you know why Maddock won't let me try for knighthood? Because he thinks I'm weak. Jude, she cautions. I thought I was supposed to be good and follow the rules, I say. But I'm done with being weak. I am done with being good. I think I'm going to be something else. Only idiots aren't scared of things that are scary, Taryn says. Which is undoubtedly true, but still fails to dissuade me. Skip lessons today, I tell her again. But she won't, so we go to school together. Taryn watches me warily as I talk with the leader of the mock war, Fand, a pixie girl with skin the blue of flower petals. She reminds me that there's a run-through tomorrow in preparation for the tournament. I nod, biting the inside of my cheek. No one needs to know that my hopes were dashed. No one needs to know I ever had any hope at all. Later, when Cardan, Locke, Nicasia, and Valyrian sit down to their lunch, they have to spit out their food in choking horror. All around them are the less awful children of fairy nobles, eating their bread and honey, their cakes and roasted pigeons, their elderflower jam with biscuits and cheese, and the fat globes of grapes. But every single morsel in each of my enemies' baskets has been well and thoroughly salted. Cardan's gaze catches mine, and I can't help the evil smile that pulls up the corners of my mouth. His eyes are bright as coals, his hatred a living thing, shimmering in the air between us like the air above black rocks on a blazing summer day. "Have you lost your wits?" Taryn demands, shaking my shoulders so that I have to turn to her. "You're making everything worse. There's a reason no one stands up to them." "I know," I say softly, unable to keep the smile off my lips. "A lot of reasons." She's right to be worried. I just declared war. Chapter 6. I've told this story all wrong. There are things I really ought to have said about growing up in Faerie. I left them out of the story, mostly because I am a coward. I don't even like to let myself think about them. But maybe knowing a few relevant details about my past will make more sense of why I am the way I am. How fear seeped into my marrow. How I learned to pretend it away. So here are three things I should have told you about myself before, but didn't. 1. When I was 9, one of Maddox's guards bit off the very top of the ring finger on my left hand. We were outside, and when I screamed, he pushed me hard enough that my head smacked into a wooden post in the stables. Then he made me stand there while he chewed the piece he'd bitten off. He told me exactly how much he hated mortals. I bled so much. He wouldn't think that much blood could come out of a finger. When it was over, he explained that I better keep what happened secret, because if I didn't, he'd eat the rest of me. So, obviously, I didn't tell anyone. Until now, when I am telling you. 2. When I was 11, I was spotted hiding under the banquet table at one of the revels by a particularly bored member of the gentry. He dragged me out by my foot, kicking and squirming. I don't think he knew who I was. At least, I tell myself he didn't. But he compelled me to drink. And so I drank. The grass-green fairy wine slipping down my throat like nectar. He danced me around the hill. It was fun at first. The kind of terrifying fun that makes you screech to be put down half the time and feel dizzy and sick the rest. But when the fun wore off, and I couldn't stop, it was just terrifying. It turned out that my fear was equally amusing to him, though. Princess Elowyn found me at the end of the revel, puking and crying. She didn't ask me a single thing about how I got that way. She just handed me over to Oriana like I was a misplaced jacket. We never told Maddox about it. What would have been the point? Everyone who saw me probably thought I was having a grand old time. 3. When I was 14 and Oak was 4, he glamored me. He didn't mean to. Well, at least he didn't really understand why he shouldn't. I wasn't wearing any protective charms because I'd just come out of a bath. Oak didn't want to go to bed. He told me to play dolls with him, so we played. He commanded me to chase him, so we played chase through the halls. Then he figured out he could make me slap myself, which was very funny. Tatterfell came upon us hours later, took a good look at my reddened cheeks and the tears in my eyes, and then ran for Oriana. For weeks, a giggling Oak tried to glamour me into getting him sweets, or lifting him above my head, or spitting at the dinner table, even though it never worked. Even though I wore a strand of rowan berries everywhere after that. It was all I could do for months not to strike him to the floor. Oriana has never forgiven me for that restraint. She believes my not revenging myself on him then means I plan to revenge myself in the future. Here's why I don't like these stories. They highlight that I am vulnerable. No matter how careful I am, eventually I'll make another misstep. I am weak. I am fragile. I am mortal. I hate that most of all. Even if, by some miracle, I could be better than them, I will never be one of them. Chapter 7. They don't wait long to retaliate. For the rest of the afternoon and early evening, we receive lessons in history. A cat-headed goblin named Jaro recites ballads and asks us questions. The more correct answers I give, the angrier Cardan grows. He makes no secret of his displeasure, drawling to Locke about how boring these lessons are and sneering at the lecturer. For once, we're done before dark has fully fallen. Taryn and I start for home, with her giving me concerned glances. The light of sunset filters through the trees, and I take a deep breath, drinking in the scent of pine needles. I feel a kind of weird calm, despite the stupidity of what I've done. "This isn't like you," Taryn says finally. "You don't pick fights with people." "Appeasing them won't help." I toe a stone with a slipper-covered foot. "The more they get away with, the more they believe they're entitled to have." "So you're going to what? Teach them manners?" Taryn sighs. "Even if someone should do it, that someone doesn't have to be you." She's right. I know she's right. The giddy fury of this afternoon will fade, and I will regret what I've done. Probably after a good long sleep. I'll be as horrified as Taryn is. All I have bought myself is worse problems. No matter how good it felt to solve my pride.
You're no killer. What you lack is nothing to do with experience.
And yet, I don't regret it now. Having stepped off the edge, what I want to do is fall. I begin to speak when a hand claps down over my mouth. Fingers sink into the skin around my lips. I strike out, swinging my body around, and see Locke grabbing Taryn's waist. Someone has my wrists. I wrench my mouth free and scream, but screams in Faerie are like birdsong, too common to attract much attention. They push us through the woods, laughing. I hear a whoop from one of the boys. I think I hear Locke say something about larks being over quickly, but it's swallowed up in the merriment. Then a shove at my shoulders and the horrible shock of cold water closing over me. I sputter, trying to breathe. I taste mud and reeds. I shove myself up. Taryn and I are waist high in the river, the current pushing us downstream toward a deeper, rougher part. I dig my feet into the muck at the bottom to keep from being swept away. Taryn is gripping a boulder, her hair wet. She must have slipped.
There are Nixies in this river,
Valerian says.
If you don't get out before they find you, they'll pull you under and hold you there. Their sharp teeth will sink into your skin.
He mimes taking a bite. They're all along the riverbank. Cardin closest, Valerian beside him. Locke brushes his hand over the tops of cattails and bulrushes, looking abstracted. He does not seem kind now. He seems bored with his friends, and with us, too.
Nixies can't help what they are,
Nikasia says, kicking the water so that it splashes my face.
Just like you won't be able to help drowning.
I dig my feet deeper into the mud. The water filling my boots makes it hard to move my legs, but the mud locks them in place when I manage to stand still. I don't know how I am going to get to Taryn without slipping. Valerian is emptying our school bags onto the riverbank. He and Nikasia and Locke take turns hurling the contents into the water. My leather-bound notebooks. Rolls of paper that disintegrate as they sink. The books of ballads and histories make an enormous splash, then lodge between two stones and will not budge. My fine pen and nibs shimmer along the bottom. My inkpot shatters on the rocks, turning the river vermilion. Cardin watches me. Although he doesn't lift a finger, I know this is all his doing. In his eyes, I see all the vast alienness of Faerie.
Is this fun?
I call to the shore. I am so furious that there's no room for being scared.
Are you enjoying yourselves?
Enormously,
says Cardin. Then his gaze slides from me to where shadows rest under the water. Are those Nixies? I cannot tell. I just keep moving toward Taryn.
This is just a game,
Nikasia says.
But sometimes we play too hard with our toys, and then they break.
It's not like we drowned you ourselves,
Valerian calls. My foot slips on slick rocks, and I am under, swept downstream helplessly, gulping muddy water. I panic, snorting into my lungs. I thrust out a hand, and it closes on the root of a tree. I get my balance again, gasping and coughing. Nikasia and Valerian are laughing. Locke's expression is unreadable. Cardin has one foot in the reeds, as though to get a better look. Furious and sputtering, I push my way back to Taryn, who comes forward to grab my hand and squeeze it hard.
I thought you were going to drown,
she says, the edge of hysteria in her voice. We're fine, I tell her. Digging my feet into the murk, I reach down for a rock. I find a large one and heft it up, green and slick with algae. If the Nixies come at us, I'll hold them off.
Quit,
Cardin says. He's looking directly at me. He does not even spare a glance for Taryn.
You should never have been tutored with us. Abandon thoughts of the tourney. Tell Maddox you don't belong with us. You're betters. Do that, and I'll save you.
I stare at him.
All you have to do is give in,
he says.
Easy.
I look over at my sister. It's my fault she's wet and scared. The river is cold, despite the heat of summer, the current strong.
And you'll save Taryn, too?
Oh, so you'll do what I say for her sake?
Cardin's gaze is hungry, devouring.
Does that feel noble?
He pauses, and in that silence, all I hear is Taryn's hitched breath.
Well, does it?
I look at the Nixies, watch them for any sign of movement.
Why don't you tell me how you want me to feel?
Interesting.
He takes another step closer, squatting and regarding us from eye level.
There are so few children in Faerie that I've never seen one of us twinned. Is it like being doubled? Or more like being divided in half?
I don't answer. Behind him, I see Nikasia thread her arm through Locke's and whisper something to him. He gives her a scathing look, and she pouts. Maybe they're annoyed that we're not currently being eaten. Cardin frowns.
Twin sister,
he says, turning to Taryn. A smile returns to his mouth, as though a terrible new idea has come to delight him.
Would you make a similar sacrifice?
Let's find out. I have a most generous offer for you. Climb up on the bank and kiss me on both my cheeks.
Once that's done, so long as you don't defend your sister by word or deed, I won't hold you accountable for her defiance. Now, isn't that a good bargain? But you get it only if you come to us now and leave her there to drown. Show her that she will always be alone.
For a moment, Taryn stands still, as if frozen. Go, I say. I'll be fine. It still hurts when she wades toward the bank. But of course she should go. She will be safe, and the price is nothing that matters. One of the pale shapes detaches from the others and swims toward her, but my shadow in the water makes it hesitate. I mime throwing the rock, and it jolts a little. They like easy prey. Valerian takes Taryn's hand and helps her out of the water as if she were a great lady. Her dress is soaked, dripping as she moves, like the dresses of water sprites or sea nymphs. She presses her bluish lips to Cardin's cheeks, one and then the other. She keeps her eyes closed, but his are open, watching me.
Say, I forsake my sister Jude, Nikasia tells her. I won't help her. I don't even like her.
Taryn looks in my direction, quick and apologetic.
I don't have to say that. That wasn't part of the bargain.
The others laugh. Cardin's boot parts the thistles and bulrushes. Locke starts to speak, but Cardin cuts him off.
Your sister abandoned you. See what we can do with a few words? And everything can get so much worse. We can enchant you to run around on all fours, barking like a dog. We can curse you to wither away for want of a song you'll never hear again, or a kind word from my lips. We're not mortal. We will break you. You're a fragile little thing. We hardly need to try. Give up.
Never, I say.
He smiles, smug.
Never? Never is like forever. Too big for mortals to comprehend.
The shape in the water remains where it is. Probably because the presence of Cardin and the others make it seem like I have friends who might defend me if I were attacked. I wait for Cardin's next move, watching him carefully. I hope I look defiant. He scrutinizes me for a long, awful moment.
Think on this, he says to me. All through your long, sodden, shameful walk home.
Think on your answer. This is the least of what we can do.
With that, he turns away from us, and after a moment, the others turn too. I watch him go. I watch them all go. When they're out of sight, I pull myself onto the bank, flopping onto my back in the mud next to where Taryn is standing. I take big, gulping breaths of air. The Nixies begin to surface, looking at us with hungry, opalescent eyes. They peer at us through a patch of foxtails. One begins to crawl onto land. I throw my rock. It doesn't come close to hitting, but the splash startles them into not coming closer. Grunting, I force myself up to begin walking. And all through our walk home, while Taryn makes soft, sobbing sounds, I think about how much I hate them, and how much I hate myself. And then I don't think about anything but lifting my wet boots, one step after another, carrying me past the briars and fiddleheads and elms, past bushes of red-lipped cherries, barberries, and damsons, past the wood sprites who nest in the rose bushes, home to a bath and a bed in a world that isn't mine and might never be. Chapter 8. My head is pounding when Vivienne shakes me awake. She jumps up onto the bed, kicking off the coverlets and making the frame groan. I press a cushion over my face and curl up on my side, trying to ignore her and go back to dreamless slumber.
"Get up, sleepyhead," she says, pulling back my blankets. "We're going to the mall."
I make a strangled noise and wave her away.
"Up,"
she commands, leaping again.
"No,"
I moan, burrowing deeper in what's left of the blankets. "I've got to rehearse for the tournament." Vivi stops bouncing, and I realize that it's no longer true. I don't have to fight, except that I foolishly told Cardin I would never quit, which makes me remember the river and the Nixies and Taryn. How she was right, and I was magnificently, extravagantly wrong.
"I'll buy you coffee when we get there. Coffee with chocolate and whipped cream."
Vivi is relentless.
"Come on. Taryn's waiting."
I half stumble out of bed. Standing, I scratch my hip and glare. She gives me her most charming smile, and I find my annoyance fading, despite myself. Vivi is often selfish, but she's so cheerful about it and so encouraging of cheerful selfishness in others that it's easy to have fun with her. I dress quickly in the modern clothes I keep in the very back of my wardrobe. Jeans, an old gray sweater with a black star on it, and a pair of glittery silver Converse high tops. I pull my hair into a slouchy knitted hat, and when I catch a glimpse of myself in the full-length mirror, carved so that it seems like a pair of bawdy fawns are on either side of the glass, leering, a different person is looking back at me. Maybe the person I might have been if I'd been raised human. Whoever that is. When we were little, we used to talk about getting back to the human world all the time. Vivi kept saying that if she learned just a little more magic, we'd be able to go. We were going to find an abandoned mansion, and she was going to enchant birds to take care of us. They would buy us pizza and candy, and we would go to school only if we felt like it. By the time Vivi learned how to travel there, though, reality had intruded on our plans. It turns out birds can't really buy pizza, even if they're enchanted. I meet my sisters in front of Maddox Stables, where silver-shod fairy horses are penned up beside enormous toads ready to be saddled and bridled, and reindeer with broad antlers hung with bells. Vivi is wearing black jeans and a white shirt, mirrored sunglasses hiding her cat eyes. Taryn has on pink jeggings, a fuzzy cardigan, and a pair of ankle boots. We try to imitate girls we see in the human world, girls in magazines, girls we see on movie screens and air-conditioned theaters, eating candy so sweet it makes my teeth ache. I don't know what people think when they look at us. These clothes are a costume for me. I am playing dress-up in ignorance. I no more can guess the assumptions that go along with glittering sneakers than a child in a dragon costume knows what real dragons would make of the color of her scales. Vivi picks stalks of ragwort that grow near the water troughs. After finding three that meet her specifications, she lifts the first and blows on it, saying, "Steed, rise and bear us where I command." With those words, she tosses the stalk to the ground, and it becomes a raw-boned yellow pony with emerald eyes and a mane that resembles lacy foliage. It makes an odd keening neigh. She throws down two more stalks, and moments later, three ragwort ponies snort the air and snuffle at the ground. They look a little like seahorses and will ride over land and sky, according to Vivi's command, keeping there seeming for hours before collapsing back into weeds. It turns out that passing between fairy and the mortal world isn't all that difficult. Fairy exists beside and below mortal towns, in the shadows of mortal cities, and at their rotten, derelict, worm-eaten centers. Fairies live in hills and valleys and barrows, in alleys and abandoned mortal buildings. Vivi isn't the only fairy from our islands to sneak across the sea and into the human world with some regularity, although most don mortal guises to mess with people. Less than a month ago, Valerian was bragging about campers he and his friends had tricked into feasting with them, gorging on rotten leaves, enchanted to look like delicacies. I climb onto my ragwort steed and wrap my hands around the creature's neck. There is always a moment when it begins to move that I can't help grinning. There is something about the sheer impossibility of it, the magnificence of the woods streaking by and the way the ragwort hooves kick up gravel as they leap up into the air, that gives me an electric rush of pure adrenaline. I swallow the howl clawing up my throat. We ride over the cliffs and then the sea, watching mermaids leap in the spangled waves and selkies rolling along the surf, past the fog perpetually surrounding the islands and concealing them from mortals, and then onto the shoreline, past two light state park, a golf course, and a jet port. We touch down in a small tree-covered patch across the road from the main mall. Vivi's shirt flutters in the wind as she lands. Taryn and I dismount. With a few words from Vivi, the ragwort seeds become just three half-wilted weeds among others. "Remember where we parked?" Taryn says with a grin, and we start toward the mall. Vivi loves this place. She loves to drink mango smoothies, try on hats, and buy whatever we want with acorns she enchants to pass as money. Taryn doesn't love it the way Vivi does, but she has fun. When I am here, though, I feel like a ghost. We strut through the JCPenney as though we're the most dangerous things around. But when I see human families all together, especially families with sticky-mouthed, giggling little sisters, I don't like the way I feel. Angry. I don't imagine myself back in a life like theirs. What I imagine is going over there and scaring them until they cry. I would never, of course. I mean, I don't think I would. Taryn seems to notice the way my gaze snags on a child whining to her mother. Unlike me, Taryn is adaptable. She knows the right things to say. She'd be okay if she were thrust back into this world. She's okay now. She will fall in love, just as she said. She will metamorphose into a wife or a consort and raise fairy children who will adore and outlive her. The only thing holding her back is me. I am so glad she can't guess my thoughts.
"So," Vivi says, "we are here because you both could use some cheering up. So cheer up."
I look over at Taryn and take a deep breath, ready to apologize. I don't know if that's what Vivi had in mind, but it's what I've known I had to do since I got out of bed. "I'm sorry," I blurt out.
"You're probably mad," Taryn says at the same time.
"At you?"
I am astonished.
Taryn droops. "I swore to Cardin that I wouldn't help you,
even though I came with you that day to help. I shake my head vehemently. Really, Taryn, you're the one who should be angry that I got you tossed into the water in the first place. Getting yourself out of there was the smart thing to do. I would never be mad about that.
Oh, she says. Okay.
Taryn told me about the prank you played on the prince, Vivi says.
I see myself reflected in her sunglasses. Doubled. Quadrupled with Taryn beside me.
Pretty good. But now you're going to have to do something much worse.
I've got ideas.
No, Taryn says with vehemence. Jude doesn't need to do anything. She was just upset about Matic and the tournament. If she goes back to ignoring them, they'll go back to ignoring her, too. Maybe not at first, but eventually.
I bite my lip, because I don't think that's true.
Forget Matic. Knighthood would have been boring anyway, Vivi says, effectively dismissing the thing I've been working toward for years.
I sigh. It's annoying, but also reassuring that she doesn't think it's that big a deal. One, the loss has felt overwhelming to me.
So what do you want to do? I ask Vivi, to avoid any more of this discussion. Are we seeing a movie? Do you want to try on lipsticks? Don't forget, you promised me coffee.
I want you to meet my girlfriend, Vivian says, and I remember the pink-haired girl in the strip of photos.
She asked me to move in with her.
Here? I ask, as though there could be any other place.
The mall?
Vivi laughs at our expressions.
We're going to meet her here today, but probably find a different place to live. Heather doesn't know Fairy exists, so don't mention it, okay?
When Taryn and I were 10, Vivi learned how to make ragwort horses. We ran away from Maddox's house a few days later. At a gas station, Vivi enchanted a random woman to take us home with her. I still remember the woman's blank face as she drove. I wanted to make her smile, but no matter what funny faces I pulled, her expression didn't change. We spent the night in her house, sick after having ice cream for dinner. I cried myself to sleep, clinging to a weeping Taryn. After that, Vivi found us a motel room with a stove, and we learned how to cook macaroni and cheese from the package. We made coffee in the coffee pot, because we remembered how our old house had smelled like it. We watched television and swam in the pool with other kids staying in the motel. I hated it. We lived that way for 2 weeks before Taryn and I begged Vivi to take us home, to take us back to Fairy. We missed our beds. We missed the food we were used to. We missed magic. I think it broke Vivi's heart to return, but she did it. And she stayed. Whatever else I can say about Vivi, when it really mattered, she stuck by us. I guess I shouldn't be surprised that she didn't plan to stay forever.
Why didn't you tell us? Taryn demands.
I am telling you. I just did, Vivi says, leading us past stores with looping images of video games, past gleaming displays of bikinis and flowing maxi dresses, past cheese-injected pretzels and stores with counters full of gleaming heart-shaped diamonds, promising true love. Strollers stream past, groups of teenage boys in jerseys, elderly couples holding hands.
You should have said something sooner, says Taryn, hands on her hips.
Here's my plan to cheer you up, Vivi says. We all move to the human world. Move in with Heather. Jude doesn't have to worry about knighthood, and Taryn doesn't have to throw herself away on some silly fairy boy.
Does Heather know about this plan?
Taryn asks skeptically.
Vivi shakes her head, smiling. Sure, I say, trying to make a joke of it. Except that I have no marketable skills other than swinging around a sword and making up riddles, neither of which probably pay all that well.
The mortal world is where we grew up, Vivi insists, climbing onto a bench and walking the length of it, acting as though it were a stage. She pushes her sunglasses up onto her head.
You'd get used to it again.
Where you grew up. She was 9 when we were taken. She remembers so much more about being human than we do. It's unfair, since she's also the one with magic.
The folk are going to keep treating you like crap,
Vivi says, and hops down in front of us, cat eyes flashing. A lady with a baby carriage swerves to avoid us.
What do you mean?
I look away from Vivi, concentrating on the pattern of the tiles under my feet.
Oriana acts like you two being mortal is some kind of awful surprise that gets sprung on her all over again every morning, she says. And Maddock killed our parents, so that sucks. And then there are the jerks at school that you don't like to talk about.
I was just talking about those jerks, I say, not giving her the satisfaction of being shocked by what she said about our parents.
She acts like we don't remember, like there's some way I'm ever going to forget.
She acts like it's her personal tragedy and hers alone.
And you didn't like it.
Vivi looks immensely pleased with herself for that particular riposte.
Did you really think that being a knight would make everything better?
I don't know, I say. Vivi swings on Taryn.
What about you?
Fairy is all we know. Taryn holds up a hand to forestall any more argument.
Here, we wouldn't have anything. There'd be no balls, and no magic, and no,
well, I think I'd like it here, Vivi snaps, and stalks off ahead of us, toward the Apple Store. We've talked about it before, of course, how Vivi thinks we're stupid for not being able to resist the intensity of fairy, for desiring to stay in a place of such danger. Maybe growing up the way we have, bad things feel good to us. Or maybe we are stupid in the exact same way as every other idiot mortal who's pined away for another bite of goblin fruit. Maybe it doesn't matter. A girl is standing in front of the entrance, playing around on her phone. The girl, I assume. Heather is small, with faded pink hair and brown skin. She's wearing a t-shirt with a hand-drawn design across the front. There are pen stains on her fingers. I realize abruptly that she might be the artist who drew the comics I've seen Vivi pore over. I begin a curtsy before I remember myself and awkwardly stick out a hand.
I'm Vivi's sister, Jude, I say. And this is Taryn. The girl shakes my hand. Her palm is warm, her grip nearly non-existent.
It's funny how Vivi, who tried so hard to escape being anything like Maddock, wound up falling in love with a human girl, as Maddock did.
I'm Heather, the girl says. It's great to meet you. V almost never talks about her family.
Taryn and I glance at each other. V?
You want to sit down or something?
Heather says, nodding toward the food court. Somebody owes me coffee, I say pointedly to Vivi. We order and sit and drink. Heather tells us that she's in community college, studying art. She tells us about comics she likes and bands she's into. We dodge awkward questions. We lie. When Vivi gets up to throw away our trash, Heather asks us if she's the first girlfriend Vivi has let us meet. Taryn nods.
That must mean she likes you a lot. So I can visit your place now? My parents are ready to buy a toothbrush for V. How come I don't get to meet hers?
I almost snort my mocha.
Did she tell you anything about our family?
Heather sighs.
No.
Our dad is really conservative, I say. A boy with spiky black hair and a wallet chain passes us, smiling in my direction. I have no idea what he wants. Maybe he knows Heather. She's not paying attention. I don't smile back.
Does he even know V is bi?
Heather asks, astonished, but then Vivi returns to the table, so we don't have to keep making up stuff. Liking both girls and boys is the only thing in this scenario Maddock wouldn't be upset with Vivi about. After that, the four of us wander the mall, trying on purple lipsticks and eating sour apple candy slices crusted in sugar that turn my tongue green. I delight in the chemicals that would doubtless sicken all the lords and ladies at the court. Heather seems nice. Heather has no idea what she's getting herself into. We say polite farewells near Newbery Comics. Vivi watches three kids picking out bobblehead figurines, her gaze avid.
I wonder what she thinks as she moves among humans. At moments like that, she seems like a wolf learning the patterns of sheep. But when she kisses Heather, she is entirely sincere. I'm glad you lied for me, Vivi says as we retrace our steps through the mall. You're going to have to tell her eventually, I say. If you're serious. If you're really moving to the mortal world to be with her. And when you do, she's still going to want to meet Matic, Taryn says. Although I can see why Vivi wants to avoid that for as long as possible. Vivi shakes her head. Love is a noble cause. How can anything done in the service of a noble cause be wrong? Taryn chews her lip. Before we leave, we stop by CVS, and I pick up tampons. Every time I buy them, it's a reminder that while the folk can look like us, they are a species apart. Even Vivi is a species apart. I divide the package in half and give the other portion to Taryn. I know what you're wondering. No, they don't bleed once a month. Yes, they do bleed. Annually. Sometimes less frequently than that. Yes, they have solutions. Padding, mostly. And yes, those solutions suck. Yes, everything about it is embarrassing. We start to cut across the parking lot toward our ragwort stalks when a guy about our age touches my arm, warm fingers closing just above my wrist. Hey, sweetheart. I have an impression of a too big black shirt, jeans, a chain wallet, spiky hair, the glint of a cheap knife in his boot.
I saw you before, and I was just wondering.
I am turning before I can think, my fist cracking into his jaw. My booted foot hits his gut as he falls, rolling him over the pavement. I blink and find myself standing there, staring down at a kid who is gasping for air and starting to cry. My boot is raised to kick him in the throat, to crush his windpipe. The mortals standing around him are staring at me in horror. My nerves are jangling, but it's an eager jangle. I am ready for more. I think he was flirting with me. I don't even remember deciding to hit him. Come on! Taryn jerks my arm, and all three of us run. Someone shouts. I look over my shoulder. One of the boy's friends has given chase. Bitch! He shouts. Crazy bitch! Milo is bleeding! Vivi whispers a few words and makes a motion behind us. As she does, the crabgrass begins to grow, pushing gaps in the asphalt wider. The boy comes to a halt as something rushes by him, a look of confusion on his face. Pixie lead, they call it. He wanders through a row of cars as though he has no idea where he's going. Unless he turns his clothes inside out, which I am fairly confident he doesn't know to do, he'll never find us. We stop near the edge of the lot, and Vivi immediately begins to giggle.
Maddock would be so proud. His little girl remembering all her training, she says. Staving off the terrifying possibility of romance.
I am too stunned to say anything. Hitting him was the most honest thing I've done in a long time. I feel better than great. I feel nothing. A glorious emptiness. See, I tell Vivi, I can't go back to the world. Look what I would do to it. To that, she has no response. I think about what I did all the way home and then again at school. A lecturer from a court near the coast explains how things wither and die. Cardin gives me a significant look as she explains decomposition rot. But what I am thinking about is the stillness I felt when I hit that boy. That, and the summer tournament tomorrow. I dreamed of my triumph there. None of Cardin's threats would have kept me from wearing the gold braid and fighting as hard as I could. Now, though, his threats are the only reason I have to fight. The sheer perverse glory of not backing down. When we break to eat, Taryn and I climb up a tree to eat cheese and oat cakes, slathered with choke cherry jelly. Fan calls up to me,
wanting to know why I didn't attend the rehearsal for the mock war. "I forgot," I call back to her, which is not particularly believable, but I don't care.
"But you're going to fight tomorrow?"
she asks. If I pull out, Fand will have to rearrange teams. Taryn gives me a hopeful look, as though I may come to my senses.
"I'll be there," I say.
My pride compels me. Lessons are almost over when I notice Taryn, standing beside Cardin, near a circle of thorn trees, weeping. I must not have been paying attention. Must have gotten too involved in packing up our books and things. I didn't even see Cardin take my sister aside. I know she would have gone, though, no matter the excuse. She still believes that if we do what they want, they'll get bored and leave us alone. Maybe she's right. But I don't care. Tears spill over her cheeks. There is such a deep well of rage inside me.
"You're no killer."
I leave my books and cross the grass toward them. Cardin half turns, and I shove him so hard that his back hits one of the trees. His eyes go wide. "I don't know what you said to her, but don't you ever go near my sister again," I tell him, my hand still on the front of his velvet doublet. "You gave her your word." I can feel the eyes of all the other students on me. Everyone's breath is drawn. For a moment, Cardin just stares at me with stupid, crow-black eyes. Then one corner of his mouth curls.
"Oh,"
he says,
"you're going to regret doing that."
I don't think he realizes just how angry I am, or how good it feels, for once, to give up on regrets.
Chapter 9.
Taryn won't tell me what Prince Cardin said to her. She insists that it had nothing to do with me, that he wasn't actually breaking his promise not to hold her accountable for my bad behavior, that I should forget about her and worry about myself.
"Jude, give it up."
She sits in front of the fire in her bedroom, drinking a cup of nettle tea from a clay mug shaped like a snake, its tail coiling to make the handle. She has on her dressing gown, scarlet, to match the flames in the grate. Sometimes, when I look at her, it seems impossible that her face is also mine. She looks soft, pretty, like a girl in a painting, like a girl who fits inside her own skin. "Just tell me what he said," I press.
"There's nothing to tell," Taryn says. "I know what I'm doing."
"And what's that?" I ask her, my eyebrows lifting, but she only sighs. We've gone 3 rounds like this already. I keep thinking of the lazy blink of Cardin's lashes over his coal-bright eyes. He looked gleeful, gloating, as though my fist tightening on his shirt was exactly what he would have wished. As though, if I struck him, it would be because he made me do it. "I can annoy you in the hills and also the dales," I say, poking her in the arm. "I will chase you from crag to crag across all 3 islands until you tell me something."
"I think we could both bear it better if no one else had to see," she says,
then takes a long pull of her tea.
"What?"
I am surprised into not knowing what to say in return.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, I think I could stand being teased and being made to cry if you didn't know about it." She gives me a steady look, as though evaluating how much truth I can handle.
"I can't just pretend my day was fine with you as a witness to what really happened. Sometimes it makes me not like you."
"That's not fair," I exclaim. She shrugs.
"I know. That's why I'm telling you. But what Cardin said to me doesn't matter, and I want to pretend it didn't happen. So I need you to pretend along with me. No reminders, no questions, no cautions."
Stung, I stand and walk to her fireplace mantle, leaning my head against the carved stone. I can't count the number of times she's told me that messing with Cardin and his friends is stupid. And yet, given what she's saying now, Whatever made her cry this afternoon has nothing to do with me. Which means she's gotten into some kind of trouble, all on her own. Taryn might have a lot of advice to give, but I'm not sure she's taking all of it. So what do you want me to do? I ask. I want you to fix things with him, she says. Prince Cardin's got all the power. There's no winning against him. No matter how brave or clever or even cruel you are, Jude. End this before you get really hurt. I look at her uncomprehendingly. Avoiding Cardin's wrath now seems impossible. That ship has sailed and burned up in the harbor. I can't, I tell her. You heard what Prince Cardin said by the river. He just wants you to give up. It's a blow to his pride, and it hurts his status, you acting like you're not afraid of him. She takes my arm at the wrist, pulling me close. I can smell the sharp scent of herbs on her breath. Tell him that he's won and you've lost. They're just words. You don't have to mean them. I shake my head. Don't fight him tomorrow, she continues. I'm not withdrawing from the tournament, I tell her. Even if it wins you nothing but more woe? She asks. Even then, I say. Do something else, she insists. Find a way. Fix it before it's too late. I think of all the things she won't say, all the things I wish I knew. But since she wants me to pretend everything is fine, all I can do is swallow my questions and leave her to her fire. In my room, I find my tournament outfit spread out on my bed, scented with verbena and lavender. It's a slightly padded tunic stitched with metallic thread. The pattern is of a crescent moon turned on its side like a cup, with a droplet of red falling from one corner and a dagger beneath the hole. Maddox crest. I cannot put on that tunic tomorrow and fail, not without bringing disgrace on my household. And although embarrassing Maddox might give me a contrary pleasure, a small revenge for denying me knighthood, I'd embarrass myself, too. What I should do is go back to keeping my head down. Be decent, but not memorable. Let Cardin and his friends show off. Save up my skill to surprise the court when Maddox gives me permission to seek a knighthood. If that ever happens. That's what I should do. I knock the tunic to the floor and climb under the coverlets, pulling them up over my head so that I am slightly smothered, so that I can breathe in my own warm breath. I fall asleep like that. In the afternoon, when I rise, the garment is wrinkled, and I have no one to blame but myself.
You are a foolish child, Tatterfell says, scraping my hair into tight warrior braids. With a memory like that of a sparrow.
On my way to the kitchens, I pass Maddox in the hall. He is dressed all in green, his mouth pulled into a grim line.
Hold a moment, he says.
I do. He frowns.
I know what it is to be young and hungry for glory.
I bite my lip and say nothing. After all, he hasn't asked me a question. We stand there, watching each other. His cat eyes narrow. There are so many unsaid things between us. So many reasons we can only be something like father and daughter, but never fully inhabit our roles.
You will come to understand. This is for the best.
He says finally.
Enjoy your battle.
I make a deep bow and head for the door. My trip to the kitchen's abandoned. All I want to do is get away from the house, from the reminder that there is no place for me at the court. No place for me in Faerie.
What you lack is nothing to do with experience.
The summer tournament is being held on the edge of a cliff in Innsweel, the Isle of Woe. It's far enough that I take a mount, a pale gray horse stabled beside a toad. The toad watches me with golden eyes as I saddle the mare and throw myself up onto her back. I arrive at the grounds out of sorts, slightly late, anxious,
and hungry.
A crowd is already gathering around the tented box where the High King Eldred and the rest of the royals will sit. Long cream-colored banners whip through the air, flying Eldred's symbol, a tree that is half white flowers and half thorns, roots dangling beneath it and a crown atop. The uniting of the Seelie courts, the Unseelie courts, and the Wild Fae under one crown. The dream of the Greenbrier line. The decadent eldest son, Prince Balkan, is sprawled in a carved chair, three attendants around him. His sister Princess Rhaya, the huntress, sits beside him. Her eyes are all on the potential combatants, readying themselves on the grounds. A wave of panicky frustration comes over me at the sight of her intent expression. I so badly wanted her to choose me to be one of her knights. And though she can't now, a sudden awful fear that I couldn't have impressed her comes over me. Maybe Matic was right. Maybe I lack the instinct for dealing death. If I don't try too hard today, at least I never need to know if I would have been good enough. My group is to go first, because we are the youngest. Still in training, using wooden swords instead of live steel, unlike those who follow us. Bouts of fighting will last the whole day, broken up by bardic performances, a few feats of clever magic, displays of archery, and other skills. I can smell spiced wine in the air, but not yet that other perfume of tournaments, fresh blood. Fand is organizing us into rows, handing out armbands in silver and gold. Her blue skin is even more blazingly cerulean under the bright sky. Her armor is varying shades of blue as well, from oceanic to berry, with her green sash cutting across the breastplate. She will stand out no matter how she fares, which is a calculated risk. If she does well, the audience cannot fail to notice. But she'd better do well. As I approach the other students with their practice swords, I hear my name whispered. Unnerved, I look around, only to realize I am being scrutinized in a new way. Taryn and I are always noticeable, being mortal. But what makes us stand out is also what makes us unworthy of much regard. Today, however, that's not so. The children of Faerie seem to be holding a single indrawn breath, waiting to see what my punishment will be for putting hands on Cardin the day before. Waiting to see what I am going to do next. I look across the field at Cardin and his friends, with silver on their arms. Cardin is wearing silver on his chest, too. A plate of gleaming steel that hooks over his shoulders and seems more ornamental than protective. Valyrian smirks at me. I do not give him the satisfaction of smirking back. Fan gives me a gold band and tells me where to stand. There are to be three rounds in the mock war and two sides. Each side has a cloak of hide to protect. One, that of a yellow deer. The other, that of silvery fox fur. I drink some water out of a pewter carafe set out for participants and begin to warm up. My stomach is sour with the lack of food, but I no longer feel hungry. I feel sick, eaten up with nerves. I try to ignore everything but the exercises I move through to limber up my muscles. And then it is time. We troop onto the field and salute the seat of the High King, although Eldred has not yet arrived. The crowd is thinner than it will be closer to sunset. Prince Dane is there, though, with Matic beside him. Princess Elowyn strums a lute thoughtfully. Vivi and Taryn have come to watch, although I see neither Orianna nor Oak. Vivi gestures with a kebab of glistening fruit, making Princess Rhaya laugh. Taryn watches me intently, as though trying to warn me with her gaze. Fix it. All through the first battle, I fight defensively. I avoid Cardin. Nor do I come near Nikasia, Valyrian, or Locke, even when Valyrian knocks Fand to the dirt, even when Valyrian rips down our deer hide. Still, I do nothing. Then we are called to the field for the second battle. Cardin walks behind me.
You're docile today. Did your sister admonish you? She desires our approval very much.
One of his booted feet toes the clover-covered ground, kicking up a clod.
I imagine that if I asked, she'd roll with me right here until we turned her white gown green, and then thank me for the honor of my favor.
He smiles, going in for the kill, leaning toward me as if confiding a secret.
Not that I'd be the first to green gown her.
My good intentions evaporate on the wind. My blood is on fire, boiling in my veins. I do not have much power, but here is what I have. I can force his hand. Cardan might want to hurt me, but I can make him want to hurt me worse. We're supposed to play at war. When they call us to our places, I play. I play as viciously as possible. My practice sword cracks against Cardan's ridiculous chest plate. My shoulder bangs against Valyrian's shoulder so hard that he staggers back. I attack again and again, knocking down anyone wearing a silver armband. When the mock war is over, my eye is blackened and both of my knees are skinned, and the gold side has won the second and third battles.
You're no killer,
Maddox said. Right now I feel that I could be. The crowd applauds, and it is as if I have suddenly woken from a dream. I forgot about them. A pixie tosses flower petals at us. From the stands, Vivi salutes me with a goblet of something as Princess Raya applauds politely. Maddox is no longer in the royal box. Balkan is gone, too. The High King Eldred is there, though, sitting on a slightly elevated platform, speaking with Dane, his expression remote. I start to tremble all over, the adrenaline draining out of me. Courtiers, waiting for better battles, study my bruises and evaluate my prowess. No one seems particularly impressed. I have done my best, have fought my hardest, and it wasn't enough. Maddox didn't even stay to watch. My shoulders slump. Worse, Cardan is waiting for me when I get off the field. I am struck suddenly by his height, by the arrogant sneer he wears like a crown. He would seem like a prince, even dressed in rags. Cardan grabs my face, fingers splayed against my neck. His breath is against my cheek. His other hand grabs my hair, winding it into a rope.
Do you know what mortal means?
It means born to die. It means deserving
of death.
That's what you are, what defines you, dying. And yet, here you stand, determined to oppose me even as you rot away from the inside out, you corrupt, corrosive, mortal creature. Tell me how that is. Do you really think you can win against me? Against a prince of faerie? I swallow hard. No, I say. His black eyes simmer with rage.
So you're not completely lacking in some small amount of animal cunning. Good. Now, beg my forgiveness.
I take a step back and tug, trying to wrench free of his grasp. He holds on to my braid, staring down into my face with hungry eyes and a small, awful smile. Then he opens his hand, letting me stagger free. Individual strands of hair flutter through the air. On the periphery of my vision, I see Taryn standing with Locke, near where other knights are donning their armor. She looks at me pleadingly, as though she is the one who needs to be saved.
Get down on your knees,
Cardan says, looking insufferably pleased with himself. His fury has transmuted into gloating.
Beg. Make it pretty. Flowery. Worthy of me.
The other children of the gentry are standing around in their padded tunics with their practice swords, watching, hoping my downfall will be amusing. This is the show they've been expecting since I stood up to him. This isn't a mock war. This is the real thing. Beg? I echo. For a moment, he looks surprised, but that's quickly replaced by even greater malice.
You defied me. More than once. Your only hope is to throw yourself on my mercy in front of everyone.
do it, or I will keep on hurting you until there is nothing left to hurt.
I think of the dark shapes of the Nixies in the water, and the boy at the revel, howling over his torn wing. I think of Terran's tear-stained face. I think of how Raya would never have chosen me, of how Matic didn't even wait to see the conclusion of the battle. There's no shame in surrender. As Terran said, they're just words. I don't have to mean them. I can lie. I start to lower myself to the ground. This will be over quickly. Every word will taste like bile, and then it will be over. When I open my mouth, though, nothing comes out. I can't do it. Instead, I shake my head at the thrill running through me, at the sheer lunacy of what I'm about to do. It's the thrill of leaping without being able to see the ground below you, right before you realize that's called falling. You think because you can humiliate me, you can control me, I say, looking him in those black eyes. Well, I think you're an idiot. Since we started being tutored together, you've gone out of your way to make me feel like I am less than you. And to coddle your ego, I have made myself less. I have made myself small. I have kept my head down. But it wasn't enough to make you leave Terran and me alone. So I'm not going to do that anymore. I am going to keep on defying you. I'm going to shame you with my defiance. You remind me that I am a mere mortal, and you are a prince of fairy. Well, let me remind you, that means you have much to lose, and I have nothing. You may win in the end. You may ensorcel me, and hurt me, and humiliate me. But I will make sure you lose everything I can take from you on the way down. I promise you this. I throw his own words back at him. This is the least of what I can do. Cardan looks at me as though he's never seen me before. He looks at me as though no one has ever spoken to him like this. Maybe no one has. I turn from him and begin walking, half expecting Cardan to grab my shoulder and throw me to the ground, half expecting him to find the Rowanberry necklace at my throat, snap it, and speak the words that will make me crawl back to him, begging, despite all my big talk. But he says nothing. I feel his gaze on my back, pricking the hairs on my neck. It is all I can do not to run. I dare not look toward Terran and Locke, but I catch a glimpse of Nikasia staring at me, open-mouthed. Valyrian looks furious, his hands fisted at his sides in mute rage. I stagger past the tournament tents to a stone fountain, where I splash my face with water. I bend down, starting to clean the gravel from my knees. My legs feel stiff, and I am shaking all over.
"Are you all right?"
Locke asks, gazing down with his tawny fox eyes. I didn't even hear him behind me. I am not. I am not all right. But he can't know that, and he shouldn't be asking. "What do you care?" I say, spitting the words out. The way he's looking at me makes me feel more pathetic than ever. He leans against the fountain, letting a slow, lazy smile grow on his mouth.
"It's funny, that's all."
"Funny?" I echo, furious. "You think that was funny?" He shakes his head, still smiling.
"No. It's funny how you get under his skin."
At first, I'm not sure I heard him right. I almost ask whom he's talking about, because I can't quite believe he's admitting that high and mighty Cardan is affected by anything. "Like a splinter," I say.
"Of iron. No one else bothers him quite the way that you do."
He picks up a towel and wets it, then kneels down beside me and carefully wipes my face. I suck in a breath when the cold cloth touches the sensitive part of my eye, but he is far gentler than I would have been to myself. His face is solemn and focused on what he's doing. He doesn't seem to notice my studying him, his long face and sharp chin, his curling red-brown hair,
the way his eyelashes catch the light. Then he does notice. He's looking at me, and I'm looking back at him, and it's the strangest thing. Because I thought Locke would never notice anyone like me. He is noticing, though. He's smiling like he did that night at the court, as though we shared a secret. He's smiling as if we're sharing another one.
"Keep it up,"
he says. I wonder at those words. Can he really mean them? As I make my way back to the tournament and my sister's, I can't stop thinking of Cardin's shocked face, nor can I stop considering Locke's smile. I am not altogether sure which is more thrilling and which more dangerous.
Chapter 10. The rest of the summer tournament goes